Hello and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, this time episode number 12, our 13th episode, because we always start at zero like any other IT person. And I'm here, as always, with Chao. How you doing?
I'm fine, Jay. It's a pleasure to be here with you for another episode. And yeah, that count is never going to get to go away from us.
Yeah, we'll always be stuck with that. Humorous, starting at zero. We should always start at zero, except for the times that we shouldn't. That's another story altogether. So we're going to talk about Ubiquiti's controversy, drama. I don't know what word to use here because we started off, you know, before this podcast even started, there was an incident where there was some sort of an alleged breach and now not so much. So there's a lot to unpack here. And what I thought I would do is just kind of give a quick summary of the UniFi platform. You know, for those of you that are listening that might not already know about it, I know a lot of people that are listening know about it, so I'll keep it short. But for the few people out there that don't know about it, I'll give a little disclaimer. So, or explainer. So the UniFi platform, basically a product of Ubiquiti, is a series of switches and access points, and they have some other equipment as well, that is controlled by one controller. So you have one controller for all of your devices. It's really popular in, you know, professional buildings, but also it's popular with home lab as well. But there's a bit of a divide because some people really don't enjoy the fact that there's a cloud aspect to this. They want to, you know, keep their network gear local, segregated, and cut off from the internet. I mean, you can't fully cut it off from the internet, but you certainly want to have your configuration local. So some people don't really like that, but other people really do enjoy the fact that there's a single console. And I like it personally. You weigh the pros and the cons if you want to get in on a platform or avoid it. For me, it's the only Wi-Fi solution that works in my house, so that's what I go with. And the controller software can be run on a virtual machine. So, for example, if you didn't want to have a cloud component running all the time, you could set up a VirtualBox VM on your local computer and just turn it on when you want to make changes and push those changes out to your equipment, shut it down when you're done. Or you could even buy a dedicated cloud key, which is like a hardware device that has a software built into it that you can use if you'd like. There's, I can go on, down a rabbit hole, but basically you have the controller. And if you want to change settings, like add Wi-Fi networks or VLANs, whatever it is you're wanting to do, you just make those changes in that component and then it gets pushed out. So management is pretty easy. And at least for me personally, it works great. This is not an endorsement. It's just an opinion. It's what I use for better or worse. And when this story, original story, which I think was like, 7 or 8 months ago, leaked,
it was at the beginning of the year. And I believe the actual breach happened late December last year. So it's almost 1 year from now.
So when that happened, and we'll get into the details here in a moment, but it's like a data breach. And that's immediately a big red flag for a lot of people because they have one component managing all their devices, and a leak of information in a cloud-enabled platform is especially egregious. So basically, it was alleged that there was a breach, that someone just got a bunch of data, and they, I think it was like 2 million or something in Bitcoin. I think it went up to like a value of $2 million was what this individual wanted, to not publish all this information out there. And then the story goes a different direction from there. But a lot of home lab people were like, yeah, no, I don't want to use this anymore because, it got breached. Some people totally rage quit, just, sold all their UniFi stuff and went a different direction. Other people were, okay, let's look at this and see what exactly happened. I don't think anybody expected the full details, or at least the details we have now, to happen, this far after the original story.
Yeah. So initially this happened and before I delve into the bridge, this is probably another case of something that is cloud connected that has no need to actually be cloud connected. Like so many devices and appliances that we have today, like TVs and all that, why do they need to be cloud connected? They just have this single use. They don't need to talk to the cloud or any other computer, but I digress. Getting back into this Ubiquiti stuff. So initially just there was just a statement in January or something from the company saying, okay, so apparently we had a data breach. We cannot confirm that any user data was accessed. And they came out with that statement. Everybody accepted that as true. And we moved on for a few months. Then in March, at the end of March, if I'm not mistaken, we had some more information. Apparently, there was this whistleblower talking to Krebs from Krebs on Security, saying that, okay, this was not just like the company announced. Apparently, there was more information that was leaked, and the hacker managed to access more information regarding users and regarding devices out in the wild, and he could basically access and control all the devices that are cloud-connected at the moment. So this exploded a bit when that extra information came out, because at that point it started to look like Ubiquiti was just covering up their own mistakes and was not coming clean to their users. And yep. You can imagine the reaction from the users at that point.
Yeah, and I believe the whistleblower was saying something to the effect of there's a lot more going on than what they're telling you. They're keeping it under wraps. Well, I mean, there's some truth to that. There definitely is a lot more going on than we knew about. But who was holding the secret there was actually the bigger question that we didn't know to ask at the time. But there was more to it. Let's give them that.
There was, in fact, more to it. Yep. And the whistleblower made another interesting comment. He actually went so far as to comment on Ubiquiti's practices internally about security and all that they weren't up to par, and that they were just basically doing a half-assed job of it. So, yeah, he was adding insult to injury there. And that will probably bite him a few months down the line, like just now, for example. But at the time, nobody knew better. So the whistleblower and his information was taken as good. And there was more to it that we still didn't know at the moment.
And their stock took a hit because of this. Because if you think about everyone's mindset, you know, if you have information in the cloud, everyone agrees, I'm sure, if you put your information in the cloud, it better be a protected place and a safe place to put that information. And when a cloud connected platform had a breach and then someone says there's more to it than that, their security isn't all that great and there's all these problems, then that's going to make a lot of people think twice about going with the platform. And like you said, we didn't think to ask any more than that. We kind of just moved on and it was what it was. And this was all before the podcast started. But recently, this week, we're recording this like on the 9th, but you know, there's a little bit of a buffer until we eventually go live. Is that it may have been an inside job. And when this news hit, it was, I mean, there's a lot of YouTubers talking about this, a lot of blogs talking about this. So, this supposed breach that happened a while back is every bit back in the news. Probably more than it was originally, at least the same, if not more, it's being talked about. And allegedly, I want to just say allegedly, because, you know, there's more information coming out and there's going to be more details and things like that. So what we're going to do is talk about a snapshot of our understanding as it is as of the date we're recording this.
And the allegedly there is especially important because, and we're going to talk about the DOJ investigation. There was an investigation after the breach, obviously, and this being an important company and having lots of customers, this was investigated. And the DOJ, the Department of Justice, came forward with an indictment. But they don't specifically name Ubiquiti as being the company on that, as the victim on that indictment, or even involved in it. But according to the sources that we checked, the facts do line up. It's like they are talking about this event, even if they don't mention it specifically on the sources. The dates match up, the names of the people involved, the actual positions that they had in the company, everything lines up, even if it's not spelled exactly like that on the documents.
Right. So, yeah, there's a little bit of a gray area there. But like you said, the details line up perfectly. The name of the individual, obviously, my understanding is that person took another job eventually after this all happened. I would hope so, trying to get the heck out of Dodge, apparently. But, you know, that we didn't know that. But, yeah, the Department of Justice had, you know, there's a document that shows Company One, I believe is what they call the company. And everything lines up. So it could have been an inside job. And one of the things I want to underscore here before we get into the main topic here is that this is one of those stories that I knew would happen eventually in our podcast because it's a very common thing. It's not always going to hit the news when there's an inside job, but we always talk about, you know, making sure you're patched, you're not running anything end of life, that you don't expose something to the internet unless it actually has to be, that you have reasonable security. We go over to the different topics of how to harden your servers while also giving everyone the disclaimer. There's no such thing as 100% security. You just do the best you can and try to get all the obvious things. But sometimes, despite all of that, even if you're doing all of that, you know, a great job of all those things, it just takes a disgruntled person or a, you know, corrupt person or something like that to circumvent all of it, because if somebody's on the inside, then they have access to things. And I hope that a company that, you know, I hope no company goes through this, but if one does, I hope they employed the principle of least privilege. Whether or not they've done that, I don't know. But even with the principle of least privilege, employees have access to something to do their job with. So there's always going to be some information. And you can't, you know, just disconnect an employee from all company information. Otherwise, how are they going to do their job? So it's a really hard balance to strike to understand what's going on. This is why logging servers are so important, where you have logs being cached or, you know, transferred to other locations. And when you look at SOC 2 certifications, they really like you to have these types of things where you know something has been tampered with or not, whether the log files have been tampered with, has someone cleared the log files, those types of things. And I think all of that comes full circle when we start talking about this story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in this specific case, it looks like the employee in question, which was an employee of the company of Ubiquiti at the time, had access to the main GitHub account and to AWS, and to their AWS account, or somehow managed to get into their AWS account and access information, not directly related to his position, but company-wide. There should be some segregation there, I believe, but again, I don't know. They do talk about the position inside the company, but I don't know at which level of the hierarchy that was. So he may legitimately had access to company-wide information at that point or not. We don't know. At least I don't. But if he did not have legitimate access to company-wide information like global tokens or the GitHub account for the whole for all of the repositories from the company, then he should not have access to those credentials, period. He wasn't supposed to. And something failed there because he did access them. But yeah, it's kind of tricky to deal with the human element. You can have all, like you said, you can have the best security in the world. You can have everything in place, but you have the people that work there. You have the sysadmins, you have the ops people, the support teams, the devs. Everybody at some point or another has some interaction with your systems, and they may have some way to get into those systems that you're not prepared against or not defended properly against or something like that. Right. But yeah, the human element, it's tricky to manage.
So yeah, you're absolutely right. So the new updates to this ongoing saga is an individual by the name Nicholas Sharp. He's the alleged in this case at the report. And correct me if I'm wrong on any of these details, because there's a lot of details here.
Yeah.
But he allegedly downloaded a massive, or at least some amount of information from the GitHub pages. He had, you know, actual data that, of course, he would have access to, but made the claim, or actually posed as a hacker that got the information and wants some money to not make it public. So made it look like a data breach, as in a vulnerability was used for someone to break into the system and grab the stuff. Probably saying that, obviously, because he doesn't want them to know it's someone on the inside. It's some bad person out there just used a vulnerability and got in.
Apparently, he cloned some 185 repositories, company repositories from GitHub or something like that. That's a whole lot of data. And it's like we talked about on one of the past episodes when we were discussing the data breaches on healthcare. When so much data moves through, somebody should notice, and apparently somebody did notice. But one other thing that he did was changing log retention policies on AWS. When he logged into AWS, in order to cover his tracks, he reduced the retention to just one day so that there was rollover, so he could be on the clear if somebody went and looked. But looking at the indictment, the DOJ actually specifies the hardware and the comments that he executed both on GitHub and on AWS. So there was some collaboration from those entities there to provide them with system logs. But they managed to paint a pretty good picture of him logging into one system, having access to the credentials of the other system, and then logging to the other one and then cloning those repositories. And yeah, the story is a bit convoluted. There's a lot to unpack there. And regarding the payment, he initially asked for 25 Bitcoins, which at the time would be something like $1 million. Remember, this was at the start of the year. He initially asked for 25 Bitcoins to not publish the data that he had. And then another 25 Bitcoins to close the backdoor that he was aware of so that it could no longer be exploited. So in total, 50 Bitcoins, almost $2 million at the valuation at the time, January 7th, I believe.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot to unpack. One thing I'm not clear on, and I don't know if you've read about this part or even if there's any information about this, like, because obviously, yeah, the articles are mentioning that the log rotation was changed to one day. So, you know, someone would have to look at the data within that day to find it. But I wonder if he like changed the policy, lifecycle policy back to its previous number, because one thought I had was if someone just went to look at the retention policy, they might be like, oh, why is it one day? Last time I looked at this, I could have sworn it was 6 months or whatever it happened to be before that. I don't know, but that's leaving a pretty big clue. If all of a sudden you look at your retention policy and someone set it down to a day, and knowing what I know about AWS, you have, you know, a log of who does what, so long as you have CloudWatch enabled. So there might be some more details there that I'm missing, but what we do know from the report is that allegedly it was changed to one day retention.
Yeah, I didn't see any mention of it being moved back. He might just be trying to cover his own tracks at that moment and didn't worry about being found afterwards. I mean, if he was just trying to get the information and run with it so that he wouldn't be caught, he might just be trying to hide his presence at the time so that he could finish the transfer.
Right.
And probably didn't care about the rest. And at that point, I imagine that covering your commands that you executed in that moment to steal the information might be enough of a deterrent for somebody investigating it.
Right.
I'm sorry for cutting you off again.
No.
I'm unsure if there is some type of logging facility behind the scenes on AWS where they manage to store this information, even if it doesn't show on the end user's control panels. Again, since the DOJ managed to actually get all the steps and all the tokens that were used, there may be some extra logging facilities there.
Yep, that makes sense. Another thing, to your point about noticing a large amount of data going out of your company, I mean, that's pretty interesting if you have like everyone's connection slowing down and you see like this massive download. But in this case, it's interesting because if it's being stored in GitHub, even if you have a paid GitHub account, it's on GitHub servers. So you're looking at your own firewalls or whatever, unless it's going through a VPN inside the company, then you'll still see it. But my understanding is that it was actually from his home IP under VPN. So that traffic, he wouldn't have seen that because it wouldn't be your data center that the data is being sucked out of. It would just be GitHub's data centers in that case. So
exactly.
That's an avenue of this I didn't even think about until now.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a pretty good point. It wouldn't go through the company's firewall because it wasn't stored inside of the company's network.
Right.
It was on the cloud, in this case, in GitHub and AWS. I do imagine, and I have no idea what billing system they have in place for their own accounts and all that with AWS and with GitHub, that there are some, I don't know, metrics or something that you can check to see what activity took place on our repositories, what activity took place on our databases or on virtual machines on AWS and all that. It might still come up as a spike, but I imagine that much smaller and much harder to notice. I say that somebody noticed it because they do mention in the report, in the indictment, sorry, that there was an employee that noticed the AWS configuration change after, I don't know how much, what amount of time afterwards after the change happened, but they do mention that another employee noticed that the retention log was changed.
Okay, so they did notice that. So maybe it could have been an audit or something, because if they're following best practice, there I am using that word again, but there's probably a recurring amount of time where they have to go in and double check that the things that are required to be set a certain way are. Now, where did this go wrong? My understanding is that his home IP address leaked, because when you use a VPN, your public IP from your cable modem or whatever it is you use is not going to be shown. But the minute that VPN connection drops before it reconnects, those packets are now going straight from your internet device to the internet with no VPN. That's why a lot of these VPN providers have something called an internet kill switch. So that way, if the VPN drops, then it would be fine. It's just going to cut everything and then restore the connection, and then it goes through. And what's especially interesting about this is that it almost seems like bad luck, because it wasn't that the VPN failed or just dropped because of a network issue. Well, it was a network issue, but my understanding is that the internet connection had an issue, like his internet provider had an issue. Mm-hmm. So he got disconnected, then reconnected. So his internet came back, the VPN would, I'm assuming, try to reconnect. But before it does reconnect, those packets are in the clear. And that's what kind of led to this discovery.
It's actually a bit more insidious. From my understanding, when his network connection came back to his home, his SSH connection retried the connection before the VPN came back. So it was his SSH connection that got pinged and got logged on the other end with his home IP address. But this is precisely why VPN software has that kill switch functionality. Almost all of them implemented in some way or another, especially the ones that are built on top of OpenVPN, which is the majority of them. They do have a kill switch that will effectively lock out your networking. If you lose your network connection by some other reason, he will prevent the connections from going out.
Right. So, you know, I've heard of, in the past, people complaining or in the news that someone is downloading a movie illegally and they're doing so through a VPN, and then the VPN drops, and then next thing you know, they get an email from their ISP. Yeah, you're downloading stuff illegally. You need to stop that. But I haven't until now heard of an indictment out of, the lack of a kill switch or not having one or whatever. So that's pretty interesting. And then SSH, I mean, right then and there, you know, you have your authorized or your auth log or whatever it is on your distro that's showing connection attempts. There's his home IP address right there in the logs of whatever server he's logging into. Then there you go.
And they managed to collect more data as well that would confirm that, both from GitHub, where he connected with his home IP address before the alleged hack happened. So they had his home IP connecting to GitHub, even without the VPN. And at that point, it wasn't because it had dropped. It was just because I assume he was trying the connection to see if the credentials worked or something. And he did that before the VPN was up, or without using the VPN. So they managed to correlate that, And yeah, it might be circumstantial, but it's pretty damn, right.
Yeah.
It's troubling for him.
It really is. And things line up very well across the board with order of operations and events. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so there's some legal aspects of this that I don't understand. Maybe you do. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But when you have a breach, I know in most places there, if it was an actual breach, you have a certain amount of time where you got to get that information out there to let people know. Could be your organization has a requirement, your customers have a requirement, there's a legal requirement in your state or a federal requirement. I'm not exactly sure. But when the Department of Justice is, you know, it's their report, my understanding, their indictment that brought this to light. So there's an investigation going on right now. So in that case, I don't know if Ubiquity is prevented from making a statement, because part of me thinks that they would want to be like, hey, there's nothing wrong with our security. We're really good. Promise. We just hired the wrong person, but it's not a systems issue. You could trust us. obviously, that may or may not be something they would want to say, but the statement didn't come from Ubiquity. It just the indictment. So makes me wonder if they have to wait until after the investigation to talk about it, or if they're just choosing not to talk about it. I'm not really sure on that.
Ubiquity did the second statement where they stick to their guns and say that customer data was not affected. It was just no personally identifiable information was breached and all that. But the timing and the order of events here is important. This happened before the Colonial Pipeline incident. And this also happened because after the Colonial Pipeline incident happened, that ransomware that shut down the pipeline in the U.S., there was stricter regulation enforced after that happened. And there was this presidential mandate that said that companies had X amount of days to come out with information regarding breaches if they happen and if they are detected. So in this case, the initial statement by Ubiquity was done before that. So they were not mandated by law that I know of to announce that information other than to provide more guidance to their users regarding something that might come out or not. But it was because they wanted to come out with that information. Some companies never do. Some companies have breaches and just cover the tracks and try to whistle to the side and ignore it. In this case, they did that initial statement, which caused everybody to panic, basically. And then a few months later, when the whistleblower came forward, which I believe already happened after the Colonial Pipelines incident, there was now the requirement for that. But since the original incident was months prior to that, they were under no legal obligation to come with that statement, best of my knowledge.
Yep. That makes sense. So far, quick summary up to now, we had the initial breach, or so we thought, that hit the news. And obviously a lot of people were concerned about that. It turns out, according to this alleged information, that the individual who or the hacker was the person inside the company, not an actual outside hacker, as was claimed. He was posing as a hacker that got information from the outside and used that to extort the company. Then the FBI investigates, seizes his devices, and then he poses as a whistleblower, claiming that he is an inside person that knows everything, and there's a lot of information here. They're hiding, they're a bad company, they're just sweeping everything under the rug. And then now it looks like the alleged hacker and whistleblower were the same person, and that person orchestrated the whole thing for financial gain and extortion. So there are lots of individual parts, and I think there's probably...
There is even another one. Mm-hmm. He was part of the team inside Ubiquity that investigated the initial breach.
Oh, wow.
And at the time, they noticed that on their logs and the IPs where stuff happened and where the connections came from, and they noticed that it was from this VPN provider. The IP belonged to a pool owned by the same VPN provider. And at the time when he was part of the team inside Ubiquity investigating the incident, he said, oh, this is from so-and-so company that has this VPN. Funny, I never used that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Sure.
Sure. And then as part of the investigation, the FBI found out that he had a 27-month subscription to that same VPN.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I've actually watched movies and TV shows where you have one person in the investigating team who ends up at the end of the story being the one. I'm not going to say which TV shows and movies, obviously, because it could be a spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen the same shows yet that I have. But it seems like a recurring thing, almost like a meme when you look at a whodunit situation where it's one of the people investigating it the entire time, and he's leading everyone else into a different direction, trying to, you know, corral them over here when the evidence is over there. It's almost movie worthy, I think.
It's like that meme from Scream where the call is coming from inside the house.
Yep.
Yeah, where they're parodying the horror movie trope that happens, that the monster or whatever is always inside the house. So it's the same thing here.
Yeah. So a lot of information here. So it's kind of like one of those stories that's going to take a while, in my opinion, with the information that we have, for me to kind of, you know, just reason with this information, kind of feel like, okay, how do I feel about Ubiquity now versus back then when I thought something completely different? Obviously, Ubiquity is still going to have some blame here because some things did happen that they should have known about, but also nobody's perfect. You make a good point that there's no reason for a cloud controller or, I mean, network hardware to be cloud-based because it's, you know, there's no reason for that. I mean, yeah, Ubiquity could just make your controller local and not talk outside your home or office network. They could do that. And obviously, by making it publicly available like that, there's a bigger requirement for security that they have to abide by. There is a risk that their reputation could go down. And before this happened, I thought, well, if a security breach does happen, then there's going to be a lot of people saying you shouldn't have put it online. You shouldn't have included a cloud component. It was only a matter of time before this happened. What I wasn't expecting is that it would happen and then end up being a inside job, almost like he was banking on the fact that so many people like thought it would happen eventually, that it wouldn't be so surprising once it did, especially the critics of the platform.
Yeah, and going back to that, this is another obvious example of something that shouldn't be cloud aware. I mean, we've had network switches, we've had wireless routers, we have this exactly the same equipment or equipment that does exactly the same job as these ones that had never had the cloud component and were working perfectly fine up to now. Mm-hmm. And then this new company comes along, they try to disrupt the market. It's the fancy word for this.
Well, they definitely did that.
Yeah, they did that. But yeah, they just... Do you know that thing that we were talking about the other day where this random company just added blockchain to their name and got, I don't know how much valuation, and they had nothing to do with blockchain? I believe we talked about it some time ago. Yeah, there was this random company. They did something completely unrelated to technology. It was when crypto was blowing up, and they decided to add blockchain to their name. So it was exactly the same name as before with blockchain to the end, and they got this amazing valuation overnight just from that alone. And every now and then there's this new buzzword that comes up or this new trend that comes up, and you just want to jump in the bandwagon, so you use that in the most awkward way possible in your product. And sometimes, not to say most times, it brings no actual value to the product. It's just a way of riding the bandwagon and staying relevant or whatever.
Right.
And you then position yourself to fall in situations like this and trip over accidents like this and have this kind of things happen. Unfortunately, they do.
They do, and I hope I'm wrong, but this might not be the last Ubiquity breach, or I should say breach in air quotes, basically. We don't know what's going to happen. I mean, this time, you know, I think a lot of people thought when the original news hit, like, of course it did. Of course there's a breach. Why wouldn't there be a breach? Why did it take this long for there to be a breach? We told, you know, the company, don't do that. They did it anyway, and now there's a breach. No surprise there. And then now there is a surprise because it wasn't someone from the outside, allegedly. So that's not a twist we thought this would take.
Yeah. And another example of something that this cloud enabled and shouldn't be. There were these riots in South Africa a few months ago because I don't recall exactly the reason why, but there was these riots and some stores got robbed and all that, and some people took some TVs, some LG TVs, I believe. And I don't want to name the wrong company here. It could have been LG or Samsung. I can't recall the exact one, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is that the company whose TVs were stolen had claimed that, oh, they had to be cloud-enabled to provide functionality for this and that and the other thing. And what ended up happening was that after those riots happened, they activated this global kill switch that as soon as those TVs were connected, because you had to connect them online to be able to set them up, as soon as they were spotted by the server, they would be deactivated. They would never work again. So what they do have with that cloud capacity is a global kill switch. They can deactivate your devices remotely without your interference, without your requirement or acceptance or whatever. And I don't know. I don't want to say that that's why they introduced the cloud capability to the device that didn't need it, but that's something that the company now has at their disposal that they did not before. And there was no way that they could do that before.
I think that is a benefit that they could brag about for sure.
Yeah. This is something that will probably look good to their investors of, see, they stole our devices, but they cannot use it. They cannot resell them on the black market or whatever. To the end user, this is a pain because it doesn't block just that. Imagine that they decide to do that. Imagine if they decide to do that on repairs and repair devices, for example, on secondhand devices or whatever. Oh, you no longer have this device. You're not the original buyer. Okay, so we'll deactivate it. It will no longer work.
That would be a horrible thing to happen for sure.
Yeah. Especially now when the right to repair is taking hold and so many people are fighting for it all over the place. This is the type of thing that is really anti-consumer and really flies in the face of that.
So
again,
I'm sorry.
Stuff that has cloud capabilities where they had no actual need for it and just exposed them to a whole new series of bad things to happen, either intentional or not.
Yeah, I think it goes without saying in a way that with great power comes great responsibility. So in a situation where equipment is stolen and then the people who stole it can't use it. They just become paperweights. That's great because they had no business with that anyway. Yeah. They didn't pay for it. So good. I'm glad that, you know, is being deactivated. Mm-hmm. And I also hope that it never gets to a situation where they just deactivate things just because the way the customer is using it isn't how they want them to use it, which, you know, could happen. Let's just hope it doesn't. But another thing I thought about, though, is because I had a situation, I think it was last year, where a friend of a friend had his Android phone stolen, and I was trying to help out with that. And I'm like, yeah, we need to like contact the wireless provider, make sure like if it shows up for activation or something that it's not allowed to be activated, that it's marked stolen. So that way it could probably be recovered. But the thing is, like, it never did show up. It never did come online. It never went for reactivation. The network never saw it try to hit their network at all ever. So I thought about it. I'm like, well, why would that be the case? And one thing I realized is, maybe the person is just, you know, stealing phones and taking the parts out of them and selling the parts, which unless it's the motherboard of the device, it's harder to deactivate a screw caddy for some kind of harness or wire harness or something that they're selling for $15 on eBay or something like that. There's all kinds of reasons why someone might take something, making me wonder, as good as it is for a company to be able to deactivate something that's stolen, that's only one reason why people steal things. There's other benefits that they can get out there that they really can't do anything about.
So that kind of makes it interesting. I wasn't trying to condone the stealing of the TVs. That was not what my intention at all. I just thought the egregious part of that, of what happened there, was that the company had at that point always denied that they had the capability to do that. So they were blatantly lying to people and to customers. And they were saying, okay, you will need to do the cloud activation when you set up the TV so that you get all the latest updates and all that. And that's basically a lie at this point.
Right.
So that was the the really egregious part of this, not the stealing. Right. Of course, that's never condoned.
Oh, of course. I wasn't saying that you were condoning anything. I think what my point was is that if a company was to say, we are building this cloud portion of our product, so that way, if someone steals your device, when it shows up, we could deactivate it and they won't be able to utilize that. Mm-hmm. The amount of money that it takes to create a cloud platform for that purpose, I would argue, takes much more money than they could ever save by deterring theft. So the manufacturing cost of all that is going to go up more than what they would be saving. So if I don't know why Unify does what they do the way they do it, but if you know, it's easy to be counter argued that that's a good thing because, you know, someone, if they can't do this, they're just going to do that. They have another way they could try to make it worthwhile. So it's really hard thing to where you're trying to do too much. And I think the perfect example is, I can't remember what year this was. It was like the most clever, hilarious hack, in my opinion, where Sony was really upset about people ripping MP3s off their CDs. So what they did is they put some copy protection in the CD to where if you put it into a CD player, it would work just fine. But track one is going to be junk data, and a CD player is just going to skip that and go to the actual track one and start playing the music. But as soon as you put it into a computer CD drive, it's going to try to read that track over and over and over again. It's never going to read the disc because it just can't. Obviously, people were listening to CDs in their computers, but someone got a magic marker and colored over the track on the bottom of the disc, just drew a line around that track and then put it in their player, and it's fine. So this, you know, millions of dollars that Sony came up with for this copyright protection was basically defeated by a Sharpie.
And that's not the first time it happens. There have been other instances where copy protection was defeated by something like that.
It's a rabbit hole when you have things cloud enabled to keep them secure and try to predict what your users are going to do with it and how they're going to try to circumvent it. And eventually, I think you're just throwing money at the cloud with very little gain. But that's just my opinion. Anyway, with this whole...
And there is another point there. Imagine about the life... Just consider the lifespan of those devices. If you have them cloud enabled and you have them only working when they are able to talk to the cloud portion of their software every so often, you won't be able to keep them running for 10 years or 15 years or 20 years like some networking equipment is still running today, because the cloud part is going to go away much sooner than that. And they will effectively be bricked at that point. This is really nasty for something like... Well, for starters, for the environment, for recycling, for all of that, because it's just going to create a lot of e-waste without any need for it. The networking equipment has the ability to outlive other equipment by a lot. I mean, lots of places are still running gigabit networks just fine with equipment that's 20 euros old. And it's still running perfectly fine. And if nobody touches it, it's going to continue running for much longer.
Right.
And if you have something like this in place, if that device has to contact the cloud provider, a cloud endpoint somewhere, and that cloud endpoint goes away in the future, then the device will stop working. So that's another good reason not to do this type of integration.
I agree. That's such a great point. That is so true. It kind of happened to me recently. I'm not going to say it totally happened to me because I am to blame for what happened ultimately, but the overhead lights in my studio here, I have them on Home Assistant, and I decided to upgrade Home Assistant to the latest version. No big deal. After I do that, I can't turn my lights on anymore. I'm like, okay, what's going on here? And what I found out was that the API from the vendor had changed, so I would need to delete it from Home Assistant and re-add it. That's not a big deal. That's easy to do. But I apparently registered the switch on the wrong server in the wrong region because it defaulted to a region. And, you know, I make mistakes too. I didn't look at it when I was clicking next. So it's in a different country. And with their new API, they see my IP is coming from the United States. They won't allow me to actually use it. Now, what I could do is reset that device and reset it up. It would be fine. Takes just 15 minutes and I'm good to go. But of course, I'm upset. I'm angry. I decide, you know what? No more. I just threw it in the garbage and replaced it with another one. And there's like $20 down the drain, but it could have been worse because they could have just said, yeah, we're not supporting that anymore. And it's happened to where companies just go a different direction and they're not going to support the thing that you bought. And I think people are just looking at the right now. This is going to solve my problem today, right now. And it's going to solve it. But then they're not looking at what could happen in a few months or a year when the company gets bought out by someone else or just goes under. You never know.
Exactly. And it's not just the 20 bucks of components that go out the drain. It's actually the rare earths that make it up. It's all the electronics that go into it.
Right.
It could be used elsewhere just fine. The components, they don't care what device they're in. So having a device thrown out into the trash or recycled or whatever, it's just a shame when it can be kept going. And it's totally wasteful to do that.
I agree 100%. And I think they're just ESP devices, most of them anyway, because you could just hack them and get one of those kits to... I mean, we can go down a rabbit hole with all this.
No, absolutely.
It's just so fascinating to think about what could happen and what probably will happen. And we'll probably be talking about this again a few times in the future. But in the case of UniFi, you weigh the pros and the cons. There's a risk there. And now we see the other side of the story allegedly is an inside job, which I especially wanted to talk about because I think this is a narrative that or a conversation people need to have. It's like, okay, what if we had an inside job here at our company? How would we deal with that? And how much information would any one person be able to access? Would they be able to access something that they don't need to do their job? Is your developer able to access HR data? I hope not. But
that's a pretty good point. Are your developers able to look at databases from stuff that they're not working on, for example? Is the access they have to the database server global rather than specifically targeted to the stuff they're working on? Do the code repositories have public access or access to everybody inside the organization when they don't need to? Those are the types of things that need to be considered on a security strategy.
Right.
And there is a pretty simple exercise. You just look at your roster, at the people working on IT on your team, and you try to imagine, okay, if this guy decides to go rogue, which systems does he have access to? What harm can he do? And you come up with a list. And it's pretty easy to spot the weak spots there, to find the weak spots there. It's the persons with the most access that you should really work into either segregating it more or making sure that those employees are not disgruntled in the first place. Most often, this happens when they're either sacked or they're just unhappy with what they're doing or something like that. And that's the type of issues that you can't solve purely from the security perspective. There's the human element there that needs to be addressed, and you should consider that seriously. But finding the weakest spots there, it's pretty easy to do. The IT supervisor, the guy in charge of IT in the company, the CIO, he should be aware of that, or the team leaders should be aware of the responsibilities and the access that each member has. And it's pretty easy to spot the problems there.
Yeah, totally agree. Another thing that I think enterprises should consider is the concept of governance. AWS, for example, has, I forgot what it's called, but they have a service that you can enable that's going to, and basically this is what governance is, what I'm referring to, that you have certain changes that if they're seen or put in place, that these are changes that should not be put in place, and someone in management needs to be alerted that something happened. An example of this could be a developer accidentally makes a database server publicly available. Then if they had governance, it could do one of two things. It could just alert the manager, hey, your person just made this publicly available. They get an email, you should know about this. Mm-hmm. Or some of them will even go back in and undo that. So if someone makes something publicly available, it'll go back in and close that down. If somebody changes log retention, if they're required to have like a certain number of years for legal purposes, then they could have the governance solution go in and flag it anytime a change like that is made. Mm-hmm. Now, one reason why it's not an excuse, I think people don't do this, is the AWS solution, I found it a little clunky to enable. It takes some work, takes some time, like everything else. And then when you go through third-party companies, that can hook into AWS and provide this for you, there's a very significant cost. But I would argue the cost of what could happen if you don't have governance in your cloud is more than what it costs.
Yeah. It basically depends on the scale of the company. If it's right. large enough to justify the cost, then absolutely it should be done. But like you said, the interfaces are a bit clunky because the cloud providers try to do everything, basically. They try to let you manage your databases, your instances. They try to let you manage the storage. They try to let you manage the virtual machines, everything. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of knobs to make available to the administrators. So the interface will always look clunky. And it's not just specific to AWS. Azure has the same issue. Whenever you try to dig a bit deeper into the... Whenever you try to go through the rabbit hole and tweak security settings or try to trace email messages or whatever, you always go through this long series of steps and these very clunky interfaces with options that are hidden away in dialog boxes and all that. So it's pretty easy to miss something. And that's basically one of the reasons why cloud architects and cloud specialists at this point are making so much money, is because you need to hire specialists for this.
Right.
It's not something that you can just get to it and, I'll find it. I'll figure it out. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, 100% agree. That's so true. We have to really keep those things in mind and at least have the conversation. What if this was to happen to us? What would we do? And what should we audit to make sure that someone doesn't have access to something that they shouldn't have access to? Are we in compliance with the local rules or laws about logging mm-hmm. and, you know, retention and things like that? Just have that conversation, with your people, because it's unfortunate that something like this happened. But I think anytime something like this does happen, it needs to be a learning experience for everyone that works in this industry. Like, can what happened to this company happen to us? And I think that's a really important thing to keep your eye on.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you.
All right. So do you have any other thoughts on the Ubiquiti breach or anything at all for that matter?
No, we'll probably have to wait for further developments. The indictment will not end here. We will have more information about this for sure in the coming months. So it's one of those topics that we will have to revisit sooner or later. But imagine the trial will provide more information.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. So definitely make sure you're subscribed to this podcast. We'll update you if there's something that you should know about, if there's more news. And I'm sure we'll be using this as an example of inside jobs for pretty much the remainder of the podcast. It's going to keep happening, and we're going to keep looking back at this like, you don't want to be like Ubiquiti and have this happen to you because, it could. So, sometimes bad examples of security or just unfortunate victims just have a way of being the nature of a conversation in security.
Yeah, absolutely. They did what?
Yeah, that's they did what or what were they thinking? Those are the two questions I ask myself the most when I read the security news these days. So, Well, all right. Well, thanks, everyone, for listening. We appreciate all of you guys. Spread the word about the podcast. That would really help us out. We appreciate each and every one of you. Thanks for listening, watching, or however you're digesting this content. And as always, I'm Jay.
I'm Joel. Thank you, everybody, for joining. See you in the next one.